Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Brian Lynn and Phil Dierking. Later, Kelly Jean Kelly will bring us America's Presidents. But first, the Swiss city of Geneva was a good place to be for food lovers earlier this month. Foodies enjoyed the tastes and smells of food from around the world at a refugee food festival. The event gave refugees from 5 countries a chance to demonstrate their cooking skills. Local restaurants turned over their cooking spaces to chefs from Syria, Eritrea, Sri Lanka, Tibet, and Nigeria. One of the refugee chefs was 29-year-old Nadim Kadem Aljami from Syria. He says cooking is a driving force in his life. He told VOA he learned how to cook from his uncle. Nadim Kadem Aljami worked in his family's restaurant in Damascus before he was forced to leave Syria in 2015. He said that he traveled from Syria to Turkey and then to Greece. From Greece, he walked all the way to Germany and then to the Swiss border. His wife and 2 daughters eventually joined him through a family reunification program. He hopes his involvement with the Refugee Food Festival will lead to a job. Louis Martin is one of the founders of Food Sweet Food, a non-governmental organization. It started the Refugee Food Festival in 2016 in partnership with the United Nations Refugee Agency. Martin told VOA the festival has 2 main goals.
The first one was to change the way we look at refugees by showcasing their skills. The second was to create a professional accelerator for the refugee chefs participating. And we asked to every restaurant to recommend the chef to his network and then create professional opportunities for him.
Martin said he became concerned after the arrival of thousands of refugees to Europe in the summer of 2015. He said their images led him and his Food Sweet Food partner, Marine Mandrila, to create the festival.
So we thought, okay, how can we leverage food? How can we leverage all what we've learned through our travels and food documentaries to create a better understanding between citizens and refugees?
Louis Martin and Marine Mandrila brought their idea to the UN Refugee Agency in Paris. Celine Schmidt works for the UN High Commissioner for Refugees. She told VOA she immediately liked their idea.
Food is a great way to create connections. It's also a great way to change the way people see refugees, because if someone eats well, he will maybe have another idea or perspective afterwards. But also it's a way to integrate refugees.
The festival offered food for people with different tastes and from different walks of life. Nadim Kadem Aljami's 5-course Syrian meal cost about $90 at one of Geneva's luxury hotels. People with less money to spend enjoyed tasty Nigerian or Ethiopian food at 2 other restaurants. Each of those meals cost about $20. Schmidt said one great part of the festival was the teamwork between the restaurant's usual chef and the refugee chef.
The chefs who have invited the refugee chefs they have all told us that they want to start again and that they learned something. And they were so happy to be able to learn from another chef, because food has always been inspired by different cultures and different spices, tastes.
United States officials now have permission to collect usernames and other social media information from all immigrants seeking to enter the country. The new rule went into effect October 18th as an amendment to the U.S. Privacy Act. The Privacy Act establishes policies for how the government can collect and use information about individuals. The measure was enacted in 1974 after Richard M. Nixon resigned from the presidency. The new amendment gives the Department of Homeland Security permission to collect social media handles, aliases, associated identifiable information, and search results. The rule affects both permanent U.S. residents and naturalized citizens. The collected information becomes part of the person's immigration records. The amendment also gives the government rights to monitor information on relatives of immigrants and doctors who treat immigrants. It also includes monitoring of law enforcement officials involved in investigations of immigrants and lawyers and others who help immigrants. The amendment says the information can be gathered from the internet, public records, public institutions, interviewees, or commercial data providers. The Department of Homeland Security, or DHS, has yet to announce specific collection or processing methods for personal information from social media. Joanne Talbot is a spokesperson for DHS. In a statement to media last month, she said the amendment does not represent a new policy. She said the agency has already been able to monitor publicly available social media to protect the homeland. Many privacy groups have criticized the collection of usernames and other social media information by U.S. border agents. They say such questioning fails to follow existing rules and violates the privacy rights of travelers. Seamus Hughes is with the Program on Extremism at George Washington University in Washington. He says one problem is the huge amount of social media data the government will collect. Purely from a practical standpoint, I don't see how DHS has the resources to implement this, he said on Twitter. U.S. officials have defended information gathering as a way to prevent possibly dangerous people from entering the country. Some experts say there is evidence the information can be helpful to the government if it is used in the right way. Major General Charles J. Dunlap, Jr. is head of the Center on Law, Ethics and National Security at Duke University in Durham, North Carolina. I can't think of any situations where this monitoring and record collection has been used in an abusive way, Dunlap said. However, he added that the program needs to be closely monitored and any abuses quickly investigated and fixed. I'm Brian Lynn.
Researchers in the United States say they have discovered how to genetically engineer corn to produce a kind of amino acid usually found in meat. The result is a food with increased nutrition that could feed animals and people around the world. The new corn, also called maize, could reduce the cost of animal food. The discovery was published online in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, a scientific journal, in early October. The researchers say the process involves putting genetic material from a bacterium into corn. Methionine is very important for humans and animals. It is one of 9 necessary amino acids that humans and animals get from food, according to the National Center for Biotechnology Information. It supports growth, helps repair skin injuries, improves hair quality, and strengthens fingers and toenails. It also helps protect cells from pollution and slows the aging process. Thomas Lustek is a professor of plant biology at Rutgers University in New Jersey and one of the writers of the study. He told VOA, "We improved the nutritional value of corn, the largest commodity crop grown on Earth." He added, "Most corn is used for animal feed, but it lacks methionine, a key amino acid, and we found an effective way to add it." The scientists genetically modified corn by adding the bacterium called E. coli into the genome of the corn plant. The scientists said they directed their efforts to increase the plant's production of the amino acid in its leaves. In an earlier version of their experiment, they found that causing the whole plant to produce methionine had bad effects on the plant's growth. According to the study, the amount of methionine in the corn kernels increased by about 57%. Joachim Messing is a Rutgers professor and director of the Waksman Institute of Microbiology. Messing said, "Scientists fed the genetically modified corn to chickens at Rutgers University to test whether the corn was healthy to eat." The author said that normally chicken food is a mixture of corn and soybean. Soybean contains some methionine. However, additional amounts of the amino acid are often added to animal food. Methionine is added because animals won't grow without it. In many developing countries where corn is a staple, methionine is also important for people, especially children. It's vital nutrition, like a vitamin, Messing said. If the genetically modified corn can be successfully marketed and sold, people who live in developing countries wouldn't have to purchase methionine supplements or expensive foods that have higher methionine, Lustek said. Currently, synthetic methionine is added to corn seeds every year, an expensive process costing several billions of dollars, said co-writer Messing. Lustek told VOA that he felt that farmers could save a lot of money every year because of this discovery. He added that in the future, it may be possible to grow corn to have higher levels of methionine without having to genetically modify it. But until then, he said, the genetically modified version is available currently and ready to go. I'm Phil Dierking.
VOA Learning English presents America's Presidents. Today we are talking about Dwight Eisenhower. He took office in 1953 and was re-elected in 1956. Eisenhower was famous before he became President of the United States. He was a general in World War II and led the Allied invasion of Europe. The attack began with the air and sea operation called D-Day. As president, Eisenhower became known for his efforts to keep peace. He tried to have good relations with the Soviet Union especially. He believed one of the best ways to do that was to build America's military strength. When Americans think of Eisenhower, they often note the growth of the U.S. defense industry and tensions with the Soviet Union. Those tensions became known as the Cold War and lasted long after Eisenhower left office. Dwight David Eisenhower was born in Texas, but raised in the state of Kansas. His parents had seven sons. The future president was the third. Eisenhower's parents did not have much money. His father worked as a mechanic. His mother was a member of the Mennonite Church, which opposed war and violence for any reason. But young Dwight, who used the nickname Ike, enjoyed reading about military history and doing physical activities. He played football and liked hunting and fishing. When he finished high school, Eisenhower earned a position at the U.S. Military Academy, better known as West Point. At first, he did not excel as a soldier. Eisenhower tested some of the Army's traditional ideas. But in time, military leaders came to value Eisenhower's ability to think independently and strategically. He accepted increasingly important positions. In only a few years, Eisenhower took command of Allied troops during World War II. He directed invasions in North Africa, Italy, and finally in Western Europe. His words, "Okay, let's go," launched the invasion of Normandy, France, on June 6, 1944. Eisenhower's personal life changed during his military years. He married a young woman named Mamie Dowd in 1916. The following year, they had a son named Dowd Dwight. However, the boy became sick and died at the age of three. In 1922, the Eisenhowers had a second son named John. Mamie and the boy spent many months separated from Dwight. And even when the family was together, they were often moving from place to place. They moved nearly 30 times during Eisenhower's military career. After he retired from active duty in the Army, Eisenhower accepted a position as president of Columbia University in New York. Then he returned to the military to lead NATO forces in Europe. In the early 1950s, Republican Party officials urged Eisenhower to be their candidate for president. Many Americans approved of Eisenhower's war record, his efforts to contain communism, and his wide smile. They seemed to agree with his campaign slogan, "I like Ike," and decisively elected him into office. His 1952 election brought an end to the Democratic Party's 20-year control of the White House. Although he declared himself a Republican, Eisenhower was a political moderate in many of his ideas. He continued some of the domestic policies of former presidents Franklin Roosevelt and Harry Truman. Eisenhower also wanted the government to invest in public works projects. Notably, he approved a bill to build more than 65,000 kilometers of roads. Today, the U.S. highway system connects all parts of the country and supports the nation's economy. Eisenhower also worked hard to have peaceful relations with other countries. In his first months as president, he signed the agreement that ended fighting in the Korean War. He also tried to ease tensions between the United States and Soviet Union. In 1952, the U.S. government tested the first hydrogen bomb. It was even more powerful than the atomic bomb. Soon, the Soviet Union carried out a hydrogen bomb test of its own. The two countries became actively involved in an arms race that made many people around the world very, very nervous. Eisenhower did not fully trust the Soviet leadership, but made some efforts to achieve an agreement on arms control. At the same time, he approved a plan for U.S. airplanes to fly secretly over the Soviet Union to gather information. In 1959, Eisenhower and the Soviet leader, Nikita Khrushchev, met in the American state of Maryland. Modern presidents use a mountain retreat there, which Eisenhower called Camp David, after his grandson. The U.S. and Soviet officials did not develop a treaty, but they did agree to meet again the following year. However, the agreement collapsed. In 1960, Soviet missiles brought down one of the American spy planes, called a U-2. The pilot was captured. At first, Eisenhower's government denied that the plane was secretly gathering information. Officials said it was only a weather aircraft. But then the Soviets produced evidence that the U-2 was, in fact, a spy plane. Khrushchev said he could not trust Eisenhower and his government, and he ended talks on limiting or disarming nuclear weapons. During his two terms in office, Eisenhower tried many ways to avoid all-out war. He approved other secret actions, especially by the Central Intelligence Agency, or CIA.
Eisenhower sent U.S. Marines into Lebanon to try to end unrest there, and he decided against ordering airstrikes on Viet Minh forces when they surrounded French troops at Dien Bien Phu, Vietnam. In all these efforts, Eisenhower used the threat of U.S. military power to help achieve his foreign policy goals. But he warned Americans against letting businesses aiding the defense industry become too powerful. In his final speech as president, Eisenhower spoke of the dangers of what he called the military-industrial complex. He did not want the country to depend only on war to resolve conflicts. And he did not want the U.S. government to spend so much on weapons that it could not provide other services to Americans. Shortly after that speech, Eisenhower retired to a home he and his wife had bought in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. Many Americans were sad to see him go. Eisenhower's presidency lasted most of the 1950s. During that time, the American economy was, for the most part, strong. Many Americans had enough money to buy homes and televisions. At the same time, Eisenhower's presidency was a time of unease. Racial discrimination was intense. In 1954, the U.S. Supreme Court declared that states could no longer have separate public schools for white and black students. Some whites strongly objected to the decision. They tried to block black students from entering schools, sometimes using violence. Eisenhower sent troops to enforce the federal law to desegregate public schools. Later, Eisenhower used the power of his office to enforce other desegregation and voting rights laws. But he did not speak up strongly in support of civil rights. He thought both those who blocked civil rights legislation and those who demanded it were extreme. Eisenhower also did not publicly criticize Senator Joseph McCarthy, who accused the U.S. government of protecting Soviet spies. Eisenhower strongly disliked McCarthy, but he permitted the Red Scare to continue until the lawmaker could discredit himself. Finally, despite Eisenhower's efforts, the Cold War did not end. In fact, tensions between the U.S. and Soviet Union increased. Although Eisenhower succeeded in keeping the country out of war, many events during his presidency created the conditions for later conflicts. Nevertheless, Eisenhower was a popular president both before, during, and after his time in office. During his final years, he wrote several books about his life, traveled, and advised later presidents. He had suffered a heart attack during his first term in office and eventually suffered another one. He died at the age of 78 with his family by his side. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.